Meeting of the Senate Committee on Transportation to order. I'd like to welcome everyone here this afternoon. I imagine you'd just as soon be outside in the sunshine after all the rainy days. But we have work to do today, and we'll start with Senate Bill 481, and I'll call Brian Doherty. All right, I'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 481.
Good afternoon, Chair Verger, and thank you again for scheduling this bill before you. Senate Bill 481 simply removes 3 to 4 words from a statute that allows ODOT to permit nonprofit organizations to offer coffee, beverages, and cookies in rest areas. What we are doing, we are embarking on an effort to upgrade these facilities. ODOT has a statutory statement that says that you cannot offer these items in a structure in a rest area. When the only structure happened to be a restroom, that seems like a pretty good idea not to be offering coffee there. Now we have structures that we're putting in there that will allow these, so you see all these Kiwanis clubs, Lions clubs, and others offering it out of a trailer in these rest areas if you look at them. This will allow them to go into a structure that we are going to be building in conjunction and with approval of ODOT, as it is their rest areas, to offer this coffee in a structure. And if you look at page 2 of my written testimony, I have a picture here. On the far left is what would be the coffee type structure. The middle is the kiosk where travel brochures would be obtained from people. The far right is where the Commission for the Blind is allowed to vend machines. And this is a much better looking, it'll be well lit and easy to use, and it'll be a much better format for this process. I do want to say that I may have misspoken earlier when I had said that there may be some involvement with federal funds that could be jeopardized if we don't pass this bill. That is not true. What we're trying to get is private sponsorship for that coffee type area, and that could be jeopardized if we can't tell them that the people that are supposed to serve the coffee out of it can't go in there, and so it would be private funds. I do want to say a little bit about TIC. The Travel Information Council was set up after we removed these types of billboard signs. They've done a wonderful job with the tourist, with the traveler information signs regarding gas, food, and lodging. They deal with the scenic byways, the Heritage Tree Program, things like this. And what they're trying now to do is, in their management of the rest areas, upgrade 30-year-old structures and make this much better for the traveling public. We work in cooperation with ODOT, and ODOT is someone we need to consult on all of this, and we will do that going forward.
Brian, can you give me a little background as to how the bill ever came about?
I'd be glad to, Senator Verger. The bill originally, if I understand it, that has the language that says ODOT may permit nonprofit organizations to offer coffee, beverages, and cookies. That's what the statute says. It says you may not offer it inside rest area structures. And my understanding from ODOT was that at that time, the rest area structure was a bathroom. And they did not think that vending coffee inside a bathroom was a good combination of events. So that was what the language originally was intended to do. So now you had these volunteers coming in, had to bring their own trailer, and you'll see those at rest areas as you go around on Memorial Weekend or others. You'll see them there in a trailer in the rest area because they cannot be in a structure. We have no intention of offering coffee in rest areas. What we now are able to do without any state funds is to put up this type of a structure, as you see on page 2, that would allow them to now come in and offer it right there where the traveler information center is, and it's a much better use of the rest area operation. TIC, TIC will be building them with private funds, and then there's another opportunity to build something bigger, a travel plaza, with federal grant money. TIC uses no general funds at all in any of its operations.
What is a travel plaza?
A travel plaza would be something a little larger. I could show it to you. It's something that has been happening in many other states, and it incorporates the tourism, the information, travel information with the restroom all in one section, the Commission for the Blind, vending machines all in one building. That's a much very nice looking building. That is something on down the road, and again, something we need to work with ODOT on in terms of configuration, design, and all those things. But there is federal money for something like that, a larger plaza. Okay. As you see, these are just three small structures that would be working in tandem at those rest areas.
Okay. Are you Cheryl?
I am Cheryl.
Well, let's let Cheryl give hers, and then we'll go.
Senator Verger and members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Gridsko. I'm the executive director of the Travel Information Council. And just to piggyback what Brian is saying, the reason that the bill is in front of you today and was submitted this time is that initial discussions with ODOT talked about the Travel Plaza concept and the fact that we could be sharing maintenance and some of the things that are draining the ODOT funds. And one of the things that we talked about was that back east, the coffee service is inside a bigger building with the visitor center and the bathrooms. And so they were good enough to give me the statutory language that we needed to change, and then we submitted the bill on behalf of that original discussion. So that's why the bill's here today.
Did you have a group that were together working on these bills? A task force of some kind, a work group?
The Travel Information Council, which includes one person from ODOT, and then other people that some of the industry members have been.
Okay, question?
Yeah. Yes, Madam Chair.
Senator Whitsett.
Several questions. The sale of coffee, beverages, and cookies, how will the funds from that be dispersed?
They are not sales. They are offered for free by the nonprofits. And that's a restriction. This is not a commercialization of the rest area and offering anything for sale. These nonprofit organizations offer these as a courtesy to the motoring public, particularly during weekends. And so this is really to allow them to come into that structure. How we would fund it would be a private type sponsor may fund the building of that. Let's say Kobo's Coffee Company. In exchange, this organization would use Kobo's Coffee, and on the back on the decaf and regular pots will say Kobo's on the pot.
Okay. These nonprofits would not be allowed to solicit donations for other purposes in those jobs.
They would not. They're in there now under a permit structure with ODOT, and there is a person from ODOT here today. It would not change whatever they're doing currently. And but I don't know. I can answer you if they have something out there that says contribute to Kiwanis. I don't know. I just know that we're not changing any effect of what they are doing, other than allowing them move into a structure rather than to sit in a trailer.
We have someone from ODOT who's going to come up. They can answer that for you. Other questions? Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ryan, I don't know if you're a constitutional lawyer, but this is very interesting. We have another bill coming up here very shortly regarding solicitation on or near the highway. Now, this is public property, right?
This is, I believe, owned and operated by ODOT, yes.
Because I'm just curious, because this parlays into what we're going to be talking about in a few moments. It says that they may not solicit them at the rest area. So can they do that? Can we tell them they can't do that? I mean, is it free speech and they can solicit anything they want, regardless of whether we say that or not?
Yikes.
Perhaps that is something that, Chair Verger, Senator Metzger, perhaps that's something that ODOT can answer better than I can. I'm looking at a very narrowly defined statute that's allowing offering of beverages by a nonprofit, and I don't know that the statute says any more about whether they can solicit or not and where it's going. I don't know. We're not trying to get into a constitutional issue here and just opening the ability for them to use a structure to offer these free items.
Yeah. Well, I was just wondering, Madam Chair, if we if some of them solicit and then they sue us for the thing that we're going to take out because we violated their free speech, it just might be an interesting juxtaposition to the other bill.
Interesting. That's a strange adjective to apply to that, but that's all right. All right. Any other questions? All right. Well, I'll ask you to step back.
Thank
and we'll,
you very much.
And we'll ask John Jackley from ODOT to come forward. Again.
Chair Verger, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm John Jackley with the Highway Division at the Department of Transportation. Appreciate the opportunity to testify today. As you know, Senate Bill 481 would allow nonprofit organizations such as the Oregon Travel Information Council to provide free coffee and other non-alcoholic beverages and cookies in buildings located at rest areas. Under the existing law, nonprofit organizations do provide free cookies and coffee at these rest areas. Our department issues permits and has administrative rules. One example is they define cookie as something that comes from a licensed facility to make sure that it was prepared in a sanitary way and it's healthy, and kind of like schools do nowadays. And generally they do do this out of trailers or other kind of portable structures at the rest areas. This change would allow the use of buildings at rest areas or new structures that might be built either by ODOT with others, with something between ODOT and the Travel Information Council. These agreements, as the previous speakers pointed out, would have to be negotiated on a case-by-case basis to make sure that we've got sufficient room in any given rest area to expand the facility. In some cases, there might be capacity issues, such as parking or the amount of available land, but we are looking forward to discussing this further with them. We think it does provide a public service, and we've got sufficient permitting in place and other safeguards to make sure that the public interest is maintained, and we're looking forward to working with them on this. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Senator Witt, you have a question.
Thank you. Chair Verger, Mr. Jackley, again, on solicitation of donations, are these nonprofits other than, you know, they dispense the free cookies and beverage and whatever, coffee? Are they allowed at that point to solicit donations for their nonprofit in that setting?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, they accept donations, but my understanding is that they don't actively solicit them. I've been to a number of these myself. Got some language here. The current statute says that the organization providing coffee or cookies may receive donations but may not solicit them. So I believe they're following the law.
Other questions?
I was just wondering, Madam Chair, how you receive donations without soliciting them.
Madam Chair, Senator DeWitt said I may leave that distinction up to the Department of Justice, but my experience is that they generally have a can or a box or something relatively informal, but they don't approach people actively and ask them for those donations.
They're an unmarked coffee can.
It's probably a passive solicitation.
All right. All right. Any other questions?
Oh, I'd just like Mr. Jackley to respond to the question about how that would be different from once you leave the rest area and you're now back on the highway, and we have the bill that says it's illegal to tell people they can't solicit because it's free speech, and this bill would that if they violate these provisions, their permit would be could be withdrawn. And tell me why that's different than anybody else who solicits. And you're saying we can't solicit this. Why is the rest area any different than the off-ramp or anything else? Why can we tell them not to solicit there and have penalties for that, but we can't do it on off-ramps? We can do it on rest areas, but not off-ramps. I mean, what's the difference?
Madam Chair, Senator Mesker, I'm not sure what the difference is. I will probably defer to my colleagues at the Department of Justice on that. I don't know.
Okay.
Senator Metzger, doesn't it remove the prohibition of solicitation?
It does. The bill that we have coming up does, because we found it was unconstitutional to prohibit them from doing that. That's why I'm saying, and we were worried that because people were taking people to court, Now, we have an amendment that will do something different, but I mean, but the purpose of that bill was that the Department of Justice was saying people were getting, were then suing the municipality saying, you can't tell me I can't do that, and they were collecting monies. And so the base bill that we're going to look at is to repeal that so they can't get the municipality's money for denying them solicitation. And this one says, you can't solicit. And I'm just wondering, are the roadside rest people, when they get their permit withdrawn, now going to sue the Department of Transportation under the same deal? That's Mr. Neely, I know, is taking this in because he'll be able to address it when we come up with the other bill. But I'm trying to figure out the difference here. That's all.
Okay.
We'll have to wait till
One follow-up question to follow Senator Metzger. Will these nonprofits who are dispensing the free materials be required to have liability insurance?
Madam Chair, Senator Woods, I don't know the answer to that, but I'll find out for you real quick.
Thank you.
The only thing that would bother me, quite frankly, is that some of the activities that have been around the rest areas is that for them to have any amount of money. I'm sure if anybody tried to take it, they'd willingly give it to them, but certainly we wouldn't want them to have any amount of money there at the rest area. All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. All right. Senator Whitson, would you like to make a motion? I've got to open a work session. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 481.
Do you want to move this?
Yeah.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 481 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Whitsett moves Senate Bill 481 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator Metzger.
Well, my only point, Madam Chair, is I'd like to make sure this is consistent with our next action, and if we hear something different. I have no problem with the bill, but if we hear something different on the next bill, then we'd have an issue. So
okay.
I'll support it, but we may have to bring it back later in this session, depending on what we hear, I think.
Okay. All right. Any discussion?
Madam Chair, I apologize. Since I was in committee and taking care of a couple of things, I didn't hear all the discussion. I'm more than willing to move this forward if you're wanting to move it right this moment as compared to maybe waiting, because I've just read through the amendments that are for 22-23, and I'm going to ask some questions. I think we still have a significant problem there with the amendments based on my reading of them, and I'm not sure from what I've heard that maybe there's an issue here that I'm not sure with.
Okay, let me do this. Let me ask Senator Whitsett to withdraw his motion. I'm going to close the work session, and I'm going to move Senate Bill 81 down in the agenda. And Senator Whitsett, so withdrawn, and I close the work session on Senate Bill 481, and we will move it to the end of the agenda. All right, I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1007. Judith?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Senate Bill 1007 that we had a hearing on at our last meeting requires road safety inspections of intermodal chassis before the chassis leave the port. It prohibits removing or tampering with inspection tags with respect to those inspections, and punishes if indeed there is tampering or removal of the inspection tag. It would that violation would be punishable by a maximum of 1 year imprisonment or a fine of $6,250 or both. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, this is from the Committee on Rules. I have a couple of people to sign up. However, I'm going to ask if the administrator of the motor carrier division is in the audience. Is there someone from ODOT that can clarify his report? All right, I'll welcome Robin Freeman to the table. Do you have a copy of his report on 1007?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Robin Freeman, Department of Transportation. I'm not quite sure what you're referring to. If you could We did provide testimony, and then I did give you a one-page.
Yeah, this is what you said.
Okay, this is the testimony that I'm interested in following up on.
I do have the testimony in front of me.
All right, and it is the last paragraph on the back page, and it's the summary. I'll give you just a minute to look over that. I hope you're able to clear this up for me.
I will try.
All right. It says, Senate Bill 1007 calls for the suspension of an intermodal chassis owner's operating authority if a port inspector finds the equipment defective. But since the owners of most chassis are shippers, not motor carriers, there is no operating authority for the department, that means the Department of Transportation, to suspend. Also, restrictions on the use of highway funds prohibit the department from taking action against any shipper. Even if a chassis owner were a motor carrier, virtually all intermodal containers move in interstate commerce, and it's not possible for Oregon to suspend interstate operating authority. Do you interpret that to mean that even if Senate Bill 1007 goes out of the committee, and even if it were to pass through the legislature, that basically we pass something that can't be enforced?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, that is our basic interpretation. We could set up a process, and we could notify the Federal Motor Carrier Administration, and they could perhaps do something if they chose to. But that would pretty much be the limitation that we have. We could also suspend their intrastate operating authority, but they don't generally operate interstate, so that would be ineffective.
Senator Brzezinski, would you like to weigh in on this as an attorney? I'm just confused by the department coming up with this summary. I was not here for the first public hearing, and I apologize for that. I was off on other legislative business. But I was very troubled when I read this, because I'm not sure exactly what I think that means as far as action by this committee.
Madam Chair, I'll be very frank with you. I'm not up to speed as to issues that you've just raised.
Okay. This is, do you have, it's Greg D'Alfonte, yep. Administrator, Motor Carrier Transportation Division. On the back side, it's the summary.
Okay.
Paragraph. Senator Metzger, did you interpret this as I did?
Well, I mean, that's how he testified, that would be a problem.
Do you see this particular as a major
sanction? Now, can I quantify? I mean, clearly, if the department isn't going to enforce it, that's a problem. That's a problem. You know, whether the interpretation is correct of, you know, how they would get at the ultimate sanction, or what they would do to keep these off the road, I don't know. Again, I'm not, you know, from a legal standpoint, that's certainly not my bailiwick. My concern would be if the Department of Transportation says we're not going to do anything, that would be a problem.
Madam Chair.
Yeah.
I've had an opportunity to just look at the summary.
Thank you.
And my opinion is that we probably want to get legislative counsel, who's, let's say, the most certified smart individuals in the area. So they have the cross-references as to, it appears DMV has taken the position that they have no authority based on certain presumptions as to who is or isn't a, let me get down to it, shippers versus motor carriers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we just need to get clarification from the attorneys who are actually versed in the area.
I think that's a good suggestion. And, Art Reverend, I'll get you to step back, and I'm going to call Pat Egan from the Port of Portland.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Pat Egan, here on behalf of the Port of Portland. I do have some comments, and I've given you some written material. And I'll just jump to, the question that you've got, that you've put up for Legislative Council, and hopefully Mr. Galpani will be able to make it over. I think he's probably watching. The confusion about that particular paragraph is the confusion about who actually owns and operates this equipment and who has the jurisdiction over the equipment. As I understand it, most of these chassis are actually owned by the steamship companies. They're either owned or they're leased by the steamship companies. And so the owner, in fact, is not a motor carrier being a legal term of art here, and someone who has a motor carrier's license. And I think the point, as I read what you've got in front of you, that Mr. Galpani was trying to make, was that if the goal here is safety, and if the goal is that if there is something, a piece of equipment that's out of order in some way needs to be taken out of service, this legislation, as it's written, would require the Department of Transportation to take action that it couldn't take because it certifies motor carriers. It does not certify steamship companies. Now, this gets me to...
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I'm sorry, Patrick, just since we're on this point. The person who's actually moving that chassis, I would assume that person is for hire, that they are covered under motor carrier law. And if that's the case, what I'm hearing is that ODOT says we have control over the tractor and the tractor owner, but not the equipment that the tractor owner is actually pulling.
Madam Chair, Senator Przanski, I think that is the case, and I also would get into the portion of my testimony that I would like to offer here, which is this is precisely why this should be on the federal level and why there should be uniform standards that apply to all private public container yards, all equipment across the board, and every state. And the good news, and what I'd like to share with the committee that I've learned even since I testified a couple of weeks on this ago, is that the U.S. Senate Commerce Committee actually passed unanimously the standards that I've passed out to the committee. Section 127 of the thicker stapled document that I handed out to you requires for the first time this kind of comprehensive safety regulation across all of these chassis. And this has been a problem, frankly, for the owners and the folks who operate this equipment, the American Association of Railroads, American Trucking Association, Ocean Carrier Equipment Management Association. This is why they've all signed up on this legislation, is it does provide uniform standards and gets at this very issue, which is they're owned by entities that are not, in fact, motor carriers, and so it's a slippery grasp that they have on the safety issue. The other thing I guess I'd add is something that I'd also learned from Mr. Galpani since we were together, and it was a question that I think Senator Metzger presented, and that is the actual safety data here, and that is that of the accidents involving motor carriers, 94% of them are driver error. Of those, in the last 10 years, there has been one accident in Oregon that was a faulty chassis, and that happened in 1997. There was a blown tire, which is very likely something that probably wouldn't have come up, frankly, in any kind of inspection, and probably not even under the inspection that's sought under Senate Bill 1007. No other vehicle was involved, and the driver walked away. And not to minimize that there's an issue here, but the issue, and this is something that I'd like to get at, which is there is no interest on the part of anyone in this room or anyone that's operating any of this equipment in unsafe equipment. Across the board, there's no one that benefits from unsafe equipment, which is, to me, one of the reasons why they have been as well-maintained as they have been in the state and why we've had one accident in the last 10 years. I think a couple of other points to add here, in addition to the fact that we're doing some of these inspections today on a visual basis, we do several hundred a month. Some of the questions that Senator Whitsitt actually had were on the cost to the port. The Terminal 6, which is where which is really the only place in the state that this bill would apply to on our facility. Does do a visual inspection today. That is a person that is actually employed by Marine Terminal Corporation, which we contract with to manage the terminal. And that position costs on the order of $212,000 annually for one position. And given that we would, under this legislation, have to do inspections for virtually the entire West Coast and do additional inspections, look into the brakes, look into the suspension system, things that are not done on the the visits that we get today, we are of the opinion that it would cost us between $3 and $4 million annually to implement this legislation. In addition, we'd have to build a new facility, which would be a capital cost that we would have to pass on all of these to shippers, which is kind of one of the points here. Again, respecting that there is a large safety issue here, which I believe should be addressed at the federal level, this is a major cost that would be passed on to Oregon shippers, assuming that we maintain service. I think that we all have an interest in maintaining service at the Port of Portland, and if we had to pass that on to our customers, it would be another, I would say, black mark on the Port of Portland in terms of providing service going forward. So I hope that answers at least part of your question, Madam Chair, on motor carrier versus the actual owner question, which has not been absolutely clear to me, but it's one of the reasons why I think this should be addressed at the federal level, and why I think the good news is that the U.S. House has now passed a version of this. The U.S. Senate is about to take action on a version that passed the U.S. Commerce Committee, Senate Commerce Committee, unanimously with the support of Senator Gordon Smith, and I believe that that's in a very good sign that you will see a federal framework on the regulations on this issue in the very near future.
Do you have any idea of what in the very near future means?
Madam Chair, that is a very good question. This is the U.S. Congress, and I'm not necessarily going to take bets. What I understand from the folks that I've talked with in D.C. on this is it could be as early as next week. It might be as late as sometime next month. But this is in the Federal Transportation Reauthorization Bill, and it is the first time that this legislation has been passed by one body of Congress and is about to be passed by the other body of Congress. Assuming there's a conference committee, I believe this is going to stay in. I think there's a very good chance that it'll stay in. The federal Senate legislation that I've passed on to the committee is much more comprehensive than the House version that I had passed out to the committee 2 weeks ago, and I've summarized it on the back of my one pager for you all to take a look at.
Robin hurried to the table when she heard your question, Senator Przanski, so I think she has some comment to make about that.
Madam Chair, Senator Przanski, I just wanted to confirm his comment that we do regulate and monitor the tractors, the trucks, once they're on the road, and we do provide inspections for safety, and that is the time when we do have authority. If there is a problem with these chassis on the road, then we would cite those, and we would also take them out of service if they were not safe to be on the road. And that, at that point, it's the truckers that are responsible for those repairs. So we have authority over the truckers, but not the chassis owners. I just wanted to clarify that point. Thank you.
Madam Chair, follow.
Yes, please.
So if that's the case, then ODOT's not saying that they don't have the ability to take appropriate action as necessary once the chassis left the yard is actually being used in transit.
Madam Chair, Senator Przanski, we have the authority to do the way station operations, which are also involve safety inspections. If we see a problem or we're aware, someone makes us aware of a problem, then we can cite them for those safety violations, and we can take the trucker out of service, which is also taking the chassis out of service, until they're repaired and safe to be on the road.
Okay. If I could add for Madam Chair and Senator Przanski, on the fourth page in on the stapled document, I think this might at least give you a sense for what the federal legislation would look like, assuming that we can get to it and get it passed, is the top of the page is the number 70, and it's provision H that says a provision at that, and this is the rules that need to be implemented, establishes a civil penalty structure consistent with Section 521B of Title 49 U.S. Code. And then sub 2 prohibits intermodal equipment providers from placing intermodal equipment in service on the public highways to the extent such providers or their equipment are found to pose an imminent hazard. And this is one of the provisions, I think, that goes up to about M of the federal legislation that's being proposed here and that's, again, been passed by a committee and is on its way to the floor. I think that's the kind of handle that you would actually need to get to this, because this has been an outstanding issue for some time. Who actually owns them? How can you enforce it if there's not a motor carrier license in some way to pull out. One thing I guess I'd add is in the comments that you may have heard about the chassis that are on our docks that are at Terminal 6 and that someone might come and take a tag and pull it off of a chassis. I guess my own personal view of this is, again, back to the common sense. Who would take a chassis that had been tagged as out of order, should not be on the road, and throw a container on the back of it and get out on the road, unless they've got some sort of a death wish? I don't see that as a reality, given that there are multiple chassis out there. The type of things that we see are broken taillights, and they get fixed there, flat tires, those kinds of things. And there are plenty of other chassis to pick up and throw a box on and take it out of the yard.
If the federal legislation passes, however, you're going to have all the costs that you just named. Maybe plus.
Madam Chair, no, actually, one of the things that we've taken into account in the figures that I've provided for you is we would be the only port on the West Coast, actually I think maybe the only one in the nation, that is given this requirement. So we would have to check every chassis every time that it comes through the Port of Portland, assuming that we have container service. Port Tacoma would not have to do this and certify it. Port of Seattle would not have to do this. None of the private yards out there would have to do this. We would be the only port given this responsibility on the West Coast. So we would be bearing all of the cost, as opposed to the framework that you see in the federal legislation, which is everyone, public, private, Washington, California, Oregon, everyone is participating in this, and everyone has a role to play in it. And everyone, I think, actually today has a role to play in it, and I believe everyone in this room believes that as well. No one has an interest in having unsafe chassis out there. The point and why we are so concerned with Senate Bill 1007 is it lands all of that cost on us, and we have to do a brake check every time it comes in. Even if it came in last week, we have to do a brake check every time. We have to do a suspension check every time. That's above and beyond what's done today. And there are inspections that are done today, both per the federal requirements and per our requirement that they be visually inspected.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, ma'am.
All right. I believe that we have someone from LC here. Hannah? Hi. Hannah, you know my dilemma here with the summary by the Department of Transportation.
I've only heard parts of it.
So. On Senate Bill 1007, I'm trying to get some clarity as to what responsibility or authority that the Department of Transportation would have if this bill were to pass.
I'm honestly not all that familiar, Madam Chair, with the federal law that goes into this.
This would be state law.
Right. I don't know. I can look into it and get back to you. I don't have much I can offer you right now.
Madam Chair,
Senator Persansky.
Based on what Robin Freeman said, I've reread and try to break the sentences down that's in the summary. I think what ODOT's basically saying is that while the stuff is in the yard, they don't have any authority over it. It's only until it actually leaves the yard. Once it's off the yard, it's on the highway system. And I would not differ, but I would correct that I don't think they're limited just to weigh stations. I think anywhere, if they set up a roadblock system and had every trucker that had a chassis pull over when they came out of the port and they found these to be defective, they could take action at that point. Mm-hmm. I think the point that they're saying is that they can't do, let's call it a preemptive strike, mm-hmm. Before they leave the port under the authority and the concerns about the restrictions on highway funds, etc.
Okay. Well, Hannah, thank you for coming in anyway.
I cannot be more helpful.
All right. Sure. Thank you very much. All right. I'm going to call, is it Lee?
Leo.
Leo
Sunday.
Madam Chairwoman Berger, members of the committee, I've got some prepared material that I think he's panning you right now. One is what my presentation today, and the rest of it is just mainly for your edification. One's a article out of a trade magazine that speaks to the federal legislation. In that article, it does reference the Teamsters position relative to what they think of the federal legislation, and I think the Teamsters position is it's not going to work, basically. A bunch of malarkey, I think, is the term they might have used. We on the longshore side agree with that. I mean, we deal with this on a regular basis. I think there's also some statements in that article, newspaper article, it references a safety organization or a group of safety organizations that point out that there's no funding along with this federal legislation. So you have, in essence, a huge unfunded liability that potentially could be put on the state. The bottom line is, for that federal legislation to work, there has to be inspections. And if you read carefully through the federal legislation, I give you as an attachment to my prepared testimony a copy of what my organization believes it will look like when it's all said and done. And if you read that very carefully, what it does is it allows the owners or somebody that they subcontract with to do it on their behalf, basically to police themselves. And the reason we're here today is because these owners haven't been policing themselves very well, you know, since they started with the chassis business back in the early 60s or in the
mid-60s. Tell me what you mean by owners. Define the owner.
The most of the owners of chassis are the steamship carriers themselves. I mentioned that in my previous testimony of April 4.
Okay.
Which you should have a copy of written testimony in your file.
Okay.
Most of them are the steamship companies. And what you have is basically they lend out these chassis, and certain facilities operate chassis pools. The Port of Portland operates a chassis pool, and in fact, the inspections that they're talking about is the pool that they operate themselves. So if I'm a motor carrier, if you will, I can go to where various pools are. It might be one at the railroad, you know, where the railroad is. There might be one at Northwest Container. There might be one at the Port of Portland. There might be one at another off-dock type facility. And I can pick up a chassis at that pool. And say, for instance, the chassis I would pick up belongs to, let's say I'm picking up a K-Line container. K-Line is the name of a company. That's a steamship company that runs containers. If I'm going to pick up a K-Line container, I need to get a K-Line chassis at some pool someplace, and I take that chassis from point A, that chassis with the container on it from point A to point B. I may keep the chassis if there's no place to leave it, or I may just drop it off where I leave that container from pool to pool. So what's happened over the years, and I don't think anybody's arguing against this, I don't see any of the arguments at the federal level by the port or anything, that nobody's, because it's a lend thing, nobody's paying attention to maintaining the fleet. And the steamship carriers really don't care, because once that's on the road, under current law, they're not responsible for it. I think we just heard testimony along those lines. The trucking company or the independent truck driver is the one that's responsible for that chassis. Most of the truck drivers that are that move containers, in inner city, within the city, or short hauls, even a lot of them that move them interstate, are so-called independent truck drivers. The ones that are moving containers in the city from places off the port facility to the port facility are paid piecemeal. They're paid by the trip, and it's not very much money. It's like $40 a trip. So the more trips they can get moving containers to the port facility from an off-dock facility during the day, the more money they can make. Now, from that money, they have to pay for their gas, their fuel, etc. Okay, even though in many cases the truck that they're using is a truck that they're leasing from some, you know, company, some trucking company. So they have a lot of incentive, if you will, to make more trips. And that's why they don't always pay attention to the you know, relative safety of that chassis. It's more important for them to make a trip, and they're willing to take a risk with that chassis. So to that extent, I take exception to what Mr. Egan said, that nobody in their right mind would take a chassis that's not safe. They do it every day. You have an article in front of you that I gave you that, of an incident that just happened in California, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks ago or a month ago, and it demonstrates where a driver took a chassis off the facility, and a cone that was still on the chassis, there was an empty chassis, the cone was still on the chassis, flew off, hit a car and killed two people inside the car. The statistics that Mr. Egan talks about relative to accidents that are a result of chassis, I take exception to as well. Simply because when you're driving those statistics, you don't always pay specific attention to the fact that it's often the chassis or the tractor that causes the accident. A good example might be if I'm rounding a corner and I don't make the corner as a truck driver. You could argue that that's driver error. But if you look closely, it might be because there's bad springs on the chassis, or at least the bad springs in the chassis have a contributing factor, that type of thing. Those things aren't put into the statistical reports, obviously, because they're going to immediately say driver error, and they're not going to do the full research, you know, of the vehicle or chassis. So I don't buy that at all. We see, I think at the last public session, I had one of my mechanics was here, and he actually testified to what he personally sees, and I think some of his testimony is a matter of the record as well. We see bad chassis all the time. We see chassis that are even under current law, they're supposed to have annual inspections, and they're out of date by sometimes years.
Are you saying that a driver would take a tagged chassis that has been tagged by an inspector as not being a safe chassis and take it?
What happens right now, and this is only at the Port of Pearl, and that's all I can speak to relative to their pool. Now, understand that they're only inspecting a small number of the chassis that come through. I would say maybe 25% of the chassis that come into the port. Only the ones that are left in their pool do they inspect. And they do a visual inspection of those chassis, and the inspector will tag them with different colored tags depending on what's wrong with them. I don't remember the colors, but just for sake of argument, say red tag means it can't be moved, and then you might have a yellow tag or some other kind of tag. What happens is the truck driver goes through, let's say it's looking for a K-line chassis rather than another company, a Hanjin or some other company, it's looking for that specific company's chassis. It will try to find the best chassis that he can get. But if there's the only chassis left is a red tag chassis, or one that maybe has something else wrong with it, but not the level of red tag, but still probably shouldn't be on the road, he will take that because he doesn't want to wait. He wants to get that $40 so he can get back and get another $40. And he will take that chassis off terminal. And that happens.
Leo, let me ask you something. Have you, not just you, but have you and others worked over time with the Port of Portland to correct the situation?
We've talked with the Port about it, but the Port is limited on what their customer, if you will, what the steamship company will allow them to do. So if you have a steamship company, for instance, that says, I don't want you looking at my chassis, then the port's not in a position to look at those chassis. Now, what this bill does is it's not a perfect bill, but it does provide for something that we think is necessary, and that's third-party inspection at a point of production at one point in the production, which involves the movement of chassis. These chassis predominantly are involved in the ocean steamship community. Most of them are their chassis. Now, they're not always going to come through that port. They might use them to go from the Port of Morro to, you know, some farmer's field. But eventually, over time, that chassis will be worked through the system and will end up in that port. So on some chassis, you might inspect it once a year. Another chassis you might inspect three times a day. But the chassis are getting inspected. Now, what the federal legislation does, first of all, I want to clear up something that I don't think Mr. Egan had a good answer for. if the federal legislation is signed by President Bush tomorrow, it goes into a rulemaking process. And if you read the version that I gave you, that rulemaking process is going to take 1 year. So the earliest that legislation will be in effect is a year from when it's signed. In the meantime, we have a problem in Oregon. There's another thing in that legislation that bothers me, and that's there's some preemptive language. And this is the part that I'm sure that the carriers like. And this is probably why they got together and agreed to accept the federal legislation. They argue that there's any state that has, I think the language is stricter rules, if you will, or rules that are not in keeping with what the federal rules is, then the federal legislation will preempt it. Well, they have a very successful program in California called the BIT program. The BIT program requires inspections every 90 days, and they have to be tagged. The consequence of that program in California is that the chassis are being inspected. At many terminals, they're being inspected on the outgate, which is exactly what this legislation is asking to be done, the Senate Bill 1007. Even if they're not inspected on the outgate at some terminals, the tags are looked at, and if a worker on the facility, a mechanic on the facility, sees that the tag is not in keeping with the 90-day inspection, that chassis is prohibited from leaving the facility until it is actually inspected. Now, I worry that this federal legislation may actually preempt the BIT program, which would be unfortunate. I think, however,
the program stronger. It can't be weaker. It can be stronger.
That's not how I read the language of the federal legislation. It says that if it's stronger, then it would have the impact of interfering with interstate commerce, and therefore the federal legislation would preempt.
Would preempt it.
Now, ultimately, some attorney general will decide, you know, which state has a stronger legislation. I look at this legislation not as being really conducive with what I'm talking now about Senate Bill 1007, as being conducive with the federal legislation. Because to make the federal legislation work, to really make it work, because these carriers are not going to police themselves. They haven't yet, and they're not going to. You have to have some form of inspection program. The federal legislation puts that onus on ODOT in the state of Oregon, but it doesn't provide any money to do it. And ODOT doesn't have money to properly inspect, because to properly inspect, you'd have to set up a roadability check right outside the terminal. Now, ODOT has done that from time to time.
They have?
Yes, they have. They have set up roadability checks, and what happens is within a half hour, no trucks come through the terminal, because it takes about a half hour for the word to get out that roadability check's there, and for all practical purposes, it closes the terminal down, which gives you some sense of the relative level of maintenance of the trucks and the chassis. But the beauty of this bill, and why I think it actually doesn't contradict what's going on with the federal legislation, it allows for the inspection to take place and ultimately be paid by the people that own the chassis rather than put it on the backs of the taxpayers. The inspection will take place. ODOT can still inspect to the extent that they have the revenue to do so and the political will. But the inspection will take place on the facility, and it saves the tax. You know, it's not something that taxpayers have to foot. I take strong exception to the port's suggestion that it costs $5 million to do this in a year. I take strong exception to that. I do accept the fact that an inspector would cost approximately, I think he said, $214,000, including benefits, plus administrative costs associated with it. That's very possible. Let's say that, and they're already inspecting some now, let's say that they have to go to two inspectors at the port facility, because they're only inspecting during the time that the port is open receiving containers, and that's only during the day. So you're looking at an 8 to 9 hour day, 5 days a week. They don't receive on the weekends unless there's some special reason that they have to. You're looking at maybe $500,000 total what it's going to cost the port. That's a drop in the bucket in the scheme of things, the way the steamship companies work. To give you an idea, a container ship that comes into Portland right now, it costs them, the charter rate on that ship is about $40,000 to $50,000 a day. That's what they're paying. I mean, just on the charter rate. So, I mean, so that $500,000 spread out over their entire tariff to everybody that brings containers in, you would almost not see it.
Well, I'm sure you would agree, however, that our shipping is way down from what it used to be. I've lived in Coos Bay 36 years, and it used to be 365 ships a year. We're under 70. Our shipping is way down, and our longshoremen really need work, and we need to have a lot more ships coming into our harbor. So I think we all have to look at the common good and be persuaded and not hurt our Oregon business, which inevitably puts people out of work, and they don't have the hours to perform. $212,000 to me sounds like an extreme salary for one person who is just doing inspections, but that's just, maybe I'm in the wrong business.
Madam Chairwoman, the individual doesn't get $212,000. I mean, we're tacking on, you know, the port's administrative costs. An individual mechanic in the Port of Portland makes about $80,000 a year, a skilled trained mechanic.
That sounds more reasonable.
That's what he makes.
All right, Neil, I'm going to open it up to some questions. Senator Whitson.
I was wondering, that $80,000, is that salary or is that total compensation?
That would be what he sees. That's his salary, and then his benefits that are paid on top of that, which...
Which would be another 30%?
The benefits for a longshoreman would be about... That same $80,000 person would probably be about $20,000, probably. I'm guessing. I'm guessing.
About 25%.
Yeah.
Okay. If I may... Couple of the questions. Do you have a quantifiable evidence of an increase in deterioration of the chassis fleet over the last 10 years?
Do I have a quantifiable evidence? I have no quantifiable. Excuse me. I'm not following the proper procedure. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Neither am I. Madam Chair,
I'm not a professional at this.
Do you have a direct evidence of any other accidents actually caused by chassis failure?
I have no direct evidence, but we had one of my mechanics who works in the chassis yard on a regular basis was here at the last session and testified to what he saw and what he sees on a daily basis.
Madam Chair, if we pass this bill out here during this session, how long would it take to build the facility and to write the rules to implement SB 1007?
Senator Whitson, I don't believe that a facility needs to be built. I watched how this works in New Jersey, and you have a mechanic, right? They do it on the in gate, and they have a mechanic that's right there in the lane. And when the chassis comes in, as they're doing the paperwork to receive the chassis, the mechanic is looking over the chassis. They're receiving the container, a certain amount of paperwork that has to be done. Even on the outgate, paperwork has to be done. During the time that the paperwork's done, the mechanic looks through the chassis visually, inspects it, and if you find something wrong with it in New Jersey anyway, they just pick his little handheld computer and he plugs it into the computer, the little codes as to what it might be, and then the chassis is set aside or it's allowed to continue.
That's not far out of touch. I am. I'm thinking of a piece of paper, you know, and how are you going to keep it dry? And you're talking about a computer.
Well, we're very computerized nowadays.
And finally, sir, how many jobs would the passage of this bill create in the Port of Portland?
They could do it with one inspector, but let's say you had two inspectors, so it would give another job like that, another job as an inspector, perhaps, probably. And it depends on how much repairs the port would do of the actual chassis. This bill doesn't require that the repairs are done at the port. They can be done elsewhere. But if the owner desires to have the repairs done on port facilities and the port has facilities to do the repairs, then the port actually could generate income from this, a tremendous amount of income. But that's totally dependent on what the owner of the chassis wants to do.
Thank you.
I'm not clear as to who you would have gone to outside of just bringing legislation to correct the problem. Would you go to the shippers? Would you go to the port? Would you, obviously you've come to the state of Oregon, but whose basic responsibility is it really in your mind that is going to have safe chassis for your drivers?
It's not my drivers. Most of the drivers are non-union. Some of them are Teamsters. Most of them are independent contractors. But, however, I think, in my mind, the one that should be responsible for it, and what I think this bill is going to do, if it's passed, is put it on the owners of the chassis, which is the steamship carriers.
Which is the shippers.
Yes. That's who's responsible, and that's who's not taking care of the fleet because they haven't had to heretofore. And I don't think with the federal legislation they're going to either, just by itself.
Okay. Lil, anything else you want to have to say?
I'd be happy to take...
Any other questions, Senator Messick? Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Not for this one, but I'll
Are you okay with this bill?
Sure, based on
okay.
At this point.
All right. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1007. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1007, and I will move Senate Bill 1007 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Right. I'll have the clerk call the roll.
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Senator Pazansky?
Aye.
Senator Starr? Senator Whitson?
No.
Chair Berger?
Aye. Senate Bill 1007 will go to the floor. I'll close the work session. I will now open a work session on House Bill 2223.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House Bill 2223 repeals two sections of statute that you see there. Pardon me. We have you have before you the Dash 1 amendments, as well as a letter from Legislative Council regarding those amendments. The Dash 1 amendments create an offense of unlawful solicitation on or near the highway if the person is soliciting employment or for a business or is soliciting contributions from persons in vehicles and that person does not have a permit from the Department of Transportation. It directs the Department of Transportation to issue a permit for solicitation if the person has adequate liability insurance. Penalty for an offense would be a fine of up to $90 with the Dash 1 amendment. Thank you, Madam Chair.
but the Dash 1 amendment doesn't replace the bill.
Correct.
They're still part of the bill.
Right. It's still okay. Repealing sections indicated.
All right. I did open the public. Did I open the public hearing?
Sorry.
I mean the work session?
Yes.
I did. Okay. I just want to be sure. All right. For purposes of discussion, Senator Pruszanski?
Madam Chair, I guess if I see Hannah's still here, maybe she's the author of the memo that's come from the Legislative Council, and I assume is also the one that authored the Dash 1s. And if she could come up, maybe we could just put some stuff on the record as to what the Dash 1s.
Okay. Welcome, Hannah.
And Madam Chair, yeah. You could ask the Department of Justice, because I requested they pursue this. Gave it to Hannah's draft, so if Haley could come up with her, that would be
all right.
Helpful. Yeah, that's fine.
All right, very good.
Hey.
All right.
Madam Chair, as the memo you have before you says, looking at these amendments, I do believe that they would remain unconstitutional. This bill originally came out in response to a court case in 1996 that was basically a three-sentence court case where the state said 814, 090, and 090, well, 090 was basically unconstitutional. State said that, the court agreed that with that, and that's why we're going through is to try and clean this up, is that we have two unconstitutional statutes that are on the books still, and we want to make it clear for law enforcement. These amendments come along, and as far as I can see, they don't do much difference. Whereas the current statutes impose a blanket prohibition, this just puts a step before the speech is restricted. We're still looking at the same problems where there is content that is being restricted, and the speech is being restricted. And it just does not seem like something that would stand up to judicial scrutiny. It's still unconstitutional.
All right. Next.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Neely, and I represent the Department of Justice. And I certainly appreciate, as always, the viewpoint of Legislative Council, and I would add that there are many, many attorneys in our department who agree with the exact viewpoint that Mrs. Lai just reported. What I can also tell you is there are other attorneys in our department who feel differently, and that they're really that traditionally. The courts have, in Oregon, in terms of Oregon law, viewed the free speech provisions of our Constitution extremely broadly. Certainly, if not the most broad interpretation in the U.S., it's one of the most broad interpretations. So in that spirit, we think that the amendment as drafted is certainly subject to a challenge. There's no question about that. And our attorneys are, as I said, divided on whether or not we would be able to prevail in such a challenge. One attorney says that this strikes me as a reasonable content-neutral measure directed at harm. That is a traditional concern of the state. And then I can tell you that another attorney points out that in Eugene v. Miller, which is a case I mentioned the last time that I was here, that a very similar provision in Eugene Code requiring essentially licensing of a street vendor was found to be unconstitutional by the courts as a Article 1, Section 8 violation. So I think that just really puts into place the very controversial nature of anything that in any way appears to limit speech. That's the real test here, is what is speech and what is conduct. And the courts have more often than not in Oregon found this type of behavior to be speech, not conduct. But again, there is a defensible argument here. In fact, we have a case in front of the Supreme Court right now called Shang Canelli that seeks to provide additional clarity, not just for you, but for our office, as to where the line is drawn between speech and conduct. I think when that case comes down, we'll probably have a much better perspective on that. But until then, it's impossible to make a absolute certain statement as to the constitutionality of these provisions.
So the only thing that would really be able to be passed here is just to remove the prohibition of solicitation. Discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I asked Mr. Neely to pursue this to see if there were this was brought up in our original hearing when we were talking about the firefighters were required to have insurance and the genesis of that and how we could do that. And Mr. Neely felt that there was there may be a way that same language and the reasoning behind it might be applied for others, and which is basically the genesis for this. And As he pointed out, they're split on it, and I asked him to bring that forward, you know, if he felt that there was justification for that. And as you heard, you know, it's kind of like half his friends say yes and half his friends say no. So that's kind of where we are right now. I think it's I think everybody's trying to address this issue, whether this gets us there or not. Obviously, as he pointed out, as Hannah pointed out, is questionable. Doesn't change the problem. We still have the issue, but this may not do it.
I guess one of my questions would be, and I well remember today that you mentioned that, about, because it did seem very inconsistent that firemen who are going to be stopping you and asking you for a donation have to have insurance. And yet I could go out and stop cars, not a fireman, and do whatever I want to do and solicit from the roadside, and I don't have to have insurance. So that seems to be not too equitable. Would you like to comment on why you think that would be fair to require firemen to have insurance and not require someone soliciting?
I don't even see why the firemen should be required to have insurance in the first place, whereas the statute's unconstitutional in the first place.
Madam Chair.
Yeah.
And going back and forth, I went down the list of council and pulled the code as it, the statutes that were in place when this case came out from the Court of Appeals, and compared it to what was currently on the book. The only change that was made in between those two times was in 1999, and that was when they added the provision that basically allowed for the firefighters to actually be there so long as they had the insurance. My position would be, as we've heard from legislative council, is that one, they didn't have the requirement based on the ruling of the court in 96, and that this was a means to maybe try to take care of it. I think it is very questionable, because the question really comes down to whether or not the restriction that we're putting in here as to requiring everyone to have liability insurance, if that would be a reasonable restriction for all. And then when you start looking at the ability for some people to pay versus others not being able to pay, mm-hmm. that is where I think the problem comes in. Sure. And I think council is right on mm-hmm. as to the Article 1, Section 8 mm-hmm. Provisions. And so, I mean, based on my review of this, there's no way that I would be able to support the dash ones mm-hmm. Or anything at this point, because I think it's very clear. I mean, that's pretty interesting. There's not too many decisions you see that virtually is like one sentence, two sentences long, and it was basically just the challenge was out of the Lane County courts, and they basically said that it was unconstitutional.
Senator Metzger, should we proceed with just the prohibition?
Well, I think that's going to be the prudent way to go. I appreciate the Department of Justice looking at this, and I think, as Mr. Neely pointed out, when the court rules on this case, we may have more guidance on what mm-hmm. that is. It's a conduct, you know, versus free speech, and maybe we're closer, but we're not close enough there to solve the problem. So I think we should just proceed with the bill as is. Appreciate the effort, though.
Madam Chair, I would say that there were a number of our attorneys who thought that Senator Metzger's idea was pretty clever.
I think it was very clever, and I want you to know that he thought of it on instant, second.
Yeah, clever but unconstitutional.
It's a dangerous line.
Madam Chair, Madam Chair, may I ask a question? Just because, and I may have to leave the committee in a little bit, but we held up 481. You may want to move that bill, and we have our attorneys here. Did you hear the discussion, Hannah, regarding Senate Bill 481 that we heard earlier?
No, I did not.
Well, there was a question. This is a bill on the rest areas, and the bill says about allowing coffee vendors at ODOT rest areas, public. And you have the bill, you have it in front of you?
Yeah.
Lines 23 and 26. I mean, 23 and 24. Can we say, but may not solicit at the rest area? I mean, is that different than what we're just now talking about? And because they have a penalty for that if you violate it. Would we have to delete the words but may not solicit the rest area to be consistent with the testimony we just heard?
Well, if we remove the mm-hmm. prohibition, it would seem like they'd be able to solicit.
No, I think the deal in this case is all of these rest stops are public rest stops. I may be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that's the case.
I didn't hear what you said, Kevin.
Trying to figure out if the rest stops are public or private.
Well, they're public.
They're public.
Yeah, it doesn't look very good.
You know, I think, Madam Chair, just I think that with the bill that we have before us, we need to just eliminate it. I think before we move ahead to 41 and have a conflict on this, is maybe we might ask the Legislative Council on 41 just to give us a day or so to look at that and see.
Okay.
And if it's necessary to delete those five words, it'd be better to meet the objective of the proponents and get the bill passed than end up having the same problem with another bill that if that's. And I know it's terrible for Mr. Nieder and Ms. Lai just to kind of ask them to do attorney opinions in 30 seconds.
If we are prohibiting, if we're removing the prohibition of solicitation, that would mean that those that were serving coffee and all could solicit. So I don't know where the conflict would be. It would be that they could solicit by keeping their can there with Kiwanis written on it or whatever, and that would be free speech. So I'm not sure where the conflict is.
Well, no, Madam Chair, I was just saying that the conflict in the bill says that they may not solicit.
Oh, they may not.
And if they do, they could lose, you know, their permit. So there's a penalty for something that we've decided that we cannot restrict based on the previous testimony.
I see. Well, when we need to, I'll have to talk with Brian.
Yeah.
We are now in work session, however. Thank you very much for coming, and you can step back. We're in work session, and
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 2223 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Whitsett moves that House Bill 2223 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? If not, so ordered. I will close the work session on House Bill 2223. Okay, we need a carrier.
Oh, I might as well carry it. I'm so deep into it now. I might as well. I'll be the guy who protects the panhandle.
That's right. That's right. Brian, would you come forward and since your bill says they may not solicit, and we have just determined that is unconstitutional, we need to have you take care of that little situation and come back.
Madam Chair,
bill with that corrected.
I understand what it feels like to be sucked into a vortex now, and we have been talking with ODOT. I will bring it up and talk with Legislative Council. They may be able to delete this. There are some issues about federal versus state laws. There's some federal regulations about not soliciting if federal dollars are involved. And this keeps getting low. We just want to move the coffee from a trailer to a structure.
That's right.
But
that's right.
But it's been the wrong day for this bill, so we will work on that and get back to you.
Just clarify the solicitation part.
We'll do that.
Back. We'll be
sorry.
Happy.
We
now know what we're doing.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. All right. I'm going to move on to House Bill 2114A.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House Bill 2114A clarifies existing law that vehicle dealers or towing businesses must remove the registration stickers on passenger motor vehicles with a gross weight of 8,000 pounds or less. Specifies that the requirement does not apply to motorcycles, mopeds, or snowmobiles. It assumes that the 8,000-pound limitation will exclude campers and motorhomes from the provisions of the bill. It retains existing exemptions to the requirement and adds an exemption for a wrecker who sells a vehicle to a dealer. It would declare an emergency effective on passage. We have received a no fiscal and no revenue impact on the measure. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Judith. Just as a disclaimer, I am a co-owner in an automobile dealership. So with that, I'll call Robin Freeman to the table.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon again. Robin Freeman from the Department of Transportation.
Today I have before you House Bill 2114A. The Department of Transportation is requesting this bill to clarify statutory changes made by passage of House Bill 2388 during the 2003 legislative session. House Bill 2388 was passed to address the problem of citizens who buy low-value passenger vehicles but fail to apply for the vehicle title registration and registration in their name as required by law. Instead, the new owners allegedly operate the vehicles under the previous owner's registration information without obtaining liability insurance for the vehicles. To resolve this issue, House Bill 2388 required a vehicle dealer or tow company, when they sold a vehicle, to remove the registration stickers from the vehicle's license plate if the dealer or tow company was not going to submit the title and registration on behalf of the new owners. In addition, when the stickers were scraped from the license plates, the dealer or tow company could issue a 10-day trip permit, and this would allow the new owners to drive to DMV to apply for title and registration. During implementation of House Bill 2388, the department discovered that the language in the bill was broader than intended. As written, all vehicle types were included in the 2003 legislation governing sticker removal, both non-motorized and motorized. So this included trailers, campers, motorhomes, motorcycles, rather than just passenger vehicles as was intended. The trip permit language is less broad and allows for motor vehicles only as was intended, but in direct conflict with the sticker removal language. The result is that sticker removal language is broadly written and applies to all vehicles, while the statute authorizing dealers and towers to issue a 10-day trip permit when a sticker is removed only applies to motor vehicles. In legislative testimony and in discussions between the department and industry representatives in 2003, agreement was reached to apply the removal of registration stickers to passenger vehicles only. There was no discussion of having the same problems with other types of vehicles, such as recreational vehicles or non-motorized vehicles. Passenger vehicles account for 87% of the vehicle records on DMV systems, with all other vehicles representing 13% of DMV's records. The department has implemented House Bill 2388 as intended and only applied it to passenger vehicles. What this bill does, 2114A, House Bill 2114A aligns statute with current practice and legislative intent. It requires stickers to be removed from passenger vehicles only, and it continues to allow for a 10-day trip permit to be issued by dealers and towers. It allows dealers and towers to not remove stickers from plates when they sell a vehicle to a person with a wrecker certificate. We ask the committee to support House Bill 2114A. It aligns statute with legislative intent and current department practice. And the bill eliminates confusion for vehicle dealers, towers, and wreckers over the removal of registration stickers and the issuance of 10-day permits. Thank you. I can answer
any questions.
I just like to put one thing on the record. Thank you, real briefly. I talked to Ms. Freeman about this, and I just want to have it on the record here, is that the removal of the stickers does not intend, and it is not written so that if a dealer, and I'm thinking an example had, and Ms. Freeman and I discussed this, it was misinterpretation, but for the record, was an antique car dealer and took a car in, had a, as permitted, an original 1940 license plate on that car, and when they sold it to the individual who was going to transfer it, the inspector who came in to inspect the dealer said he had to take the he had to confiscate the 1940 plate because they don't have stickers, and I want to make sure it's clear on the record that that is not a proper interpretation of the law, that they cannot confiscate, you know, vehicles because it's a permanent license plate, a vintage plate, just that it's only the stickers and not the plate.
Madam Chair, Senator Metzger, you are entirely correct. That is a misinterpretation of this statute.
That's all I'm going to
go for. Very good. Any other questions?
I'm still looking for my Pacific one.
All right, Robin, thank you very much, and I'll call Al Elkins.
Al's going to come back up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Tow Truck Association. I cannot add much more than what Robin has already said. What this bill does is put into statute what the intent of 2388 was in the last session and also what the current practices are. And we agree with the intent based on what Senator Metzger just said, that the sticker and not the plate. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions for Al? Well, I want to thank you for being here. I think it's always good for the department and for us to have people from like your association to come
My
and
pleasure.
Assure us that you support the bill.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Very good. All right. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2114A, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2114A.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2114A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senate Wetzel moves the House Bill 2114A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Close the work session on House Bill 2114A. I'm going to skip now to House Bill 2741A. Oh, we need a carrier for the last thing.
I'll do it.
Okay. Brzezinski.
We also need a carrier in the carrier there.
Oh, oh my God. Either I don't know. I might get one of these for the guys. Okay. Okay. Let's see. Who do I have? Judith, you tell us about 2741A.
Okay.
And after this committee, we're going to do 2825, which is a very simple bill that just gives them permission to move the plates. And then I'm going to move the public hearing for 2116 over to next week. Okay, so 2741A.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House Bill 2741A allows car rental and leasing companies to register vehicles for either an annual or biennial period. Companies wishing to use this option would pay $1 per vehicle fee. You have before you the Dash A2 amendments. If you would look on your original bill, page 3, it's replacing the bold language beginning on line 12 through 15 on page 3 with very similar language, but this language would allow the rental or leasing company to elect to do an annual, biennial, or four-year registration during an initial registration of their new vehicle, and for which, in the case where they're providing a new registration plates, and if the company in fact owns the vehicle being registered, it allows them to choose whether or not they're going for an annual, biennial, four-year registration period, but then subsequent renewal or re-registration periods would always be on a biennial basis. We have on the original bill, we received a no revenue. Oh, we do have a revenue statement issued on 2741 and a minimal fiscal impact. I'm not finding the revenue statement in my folder.
Nor I.
I will go up to the original bill file and get the revenue statement for everyone while hearing testimony.
All right. For the record, I am a co-owner in a rental car company, and having said that, I'll welcome Jim Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim Gardner. I'm appearing today for the Hertz Corporation. And House Bill 2741 was our idea. And the problem that it addresses is as follows. Right now, for new vehicles, we can only buy four-year registrations. And what happens is that for a minimal fee, when a vehicle is sold, we can recycle those plates and do so three or four times. And the reason we do that is because the industry practice, at least for the larger companies, is to keep a vehicle only 1 year. In fact, with regard to vehicles which are rented at the Portland Airport, which is the largest outlet for rental cars in the state, we're required to have fresh vehicles. We have to sell them and buy new ones approximately every year. Our current rate of purchase, we're buying for Oregon about 5,000 cars every year. When the plates are recycled, two problems arise. The first is, in essence, our problem, and it occurs if the car, as is often the case, departs the state of Oregon and is driven to California, New York, Washington, wherever. It becomes a logistical nightmare to recapture that plate and transfer it into another vehicle. The second and related problem is a problem for the renter, and that results from the fact that frequently the law enforcement data system will not capture that transfer before the new car goes out with the recycled plate. And when that happens, the state trooper may see a car description, a car make, that doesn't match the plate that's showing up on his or her computer system. And we've had instances where customers have been quite inconvenienced and embarrassed by being pulled over and told, I'm sorry, your plate doesn't match your car. And they say, well, gee, I just rented it from Hertz, but I forgot and took my little registration thing out of the car, and then it's a hassle for the customer. So this addresses both of those problems. We did put a dollar fee on it to compensate any additional expense that ODOT might encounter in doing 1-year registrations versus processing the plate transfers. I'm happy to report that the bill has no opposition, and it is supported not only by us, but by the auto dealers, Daryl Fuller, and it's good to go with CATRALA, the Car and Rental Truck Association, which is Al Elkins. I should address also the Dash 2s. We submitted the Dash A2s at ODOT's suggestion, and the exact reason for doing that was on line 5 to pick up the cross-reference, the definitional cross-references there to 803.4201 or 9A. One is the catch-all provision for passenger vehicles, and 9A is the provision for hybrids. And with that, I'll pause.
Thank you. Any questions for Jim? Okay. Senator Brzezinski?
Jim, thank you very much. You explained why the A2s are here is at ODOT, and I'm assuming that you said there's no opposition. The dollar amount, was that agreed to by ODOT as being what would be necessary to cover their costs?
Madam Chair, Senator Brzezinski, we suggested it and put it in there, and it was they did not object to it. The major change on the House side that we made to accommodate ODOT was to amend the bill so that if there were a renewal of an initial 1-year registration, that would have to be the standard 2-year renewal, because if you were to allow a 1-year renewal, that would have created an administrative burden. They'd have had to create a special tracking system for that. So that was their major concern, which we addressed on the House side. Madam Chair, I would also add that we did make a commitment to the House Chair, and we would certainly reiterate that here, that if the dollar turns out in experience to not be the right number, we'll certainly want to readdress that next session. I'm sure ODOT will share their concerns if there is an issue as it's implemented.
Thank you.
All right. I'm going to. Any other questions? Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2741A, and I'm going to open a work session. 2741A.
Madam Chair, I move the dash A2 amendment to HB 2741.
Senator Whitsett moves the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2741. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair, I move HB 2741A as amended to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Whitsett moves House Bill 2741A as amended to the House floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? If not, so ordered. I was going to move next to the commemorative plate, and I see that Mike Marsh is here, and so I'm going to go back and pick up House Bill 2738.
Do you want to carry around the...
We need a carrier. Senator Whitsett,
sure.
Would you carry that one? All right, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mike Marsh from the Department of Transportation here to present on House Bill 2738. This bill was requested at the request of the Department of Transportation for the purpose of dealing with executive support positions and allowing them to be in the unclassified service and then doing other updates and titles. In 1993, the statutes were reorganized relating to the Department of Transportation to remove references to agency divisions, and instead they referenced managers, what were called areas of critical concern. It was a title used at that time and felt to be appropriate as the legislature looked at organizational issues at ODOT. However, since that time, agencies of state government generally are using their terms for defining programs in the state government as divisions rather than areas of critical concern. They use administrators as a description of those that head those units and not the term managers. So what we've got is a request to adjust those changes so that we can have things that are updated to the latest terms and have it be less confusing for our customers as well as we work with other state agencies. I would like to have those adjustments made in order to make sure that we have more clarity with the statutes. And the fact is that executive support staff that work for agency administrators do conduct confidential business. We'd like to make sure that they can deal with employee discipline issues. They deal with email and voicemail of their boss, the division administrator. And without this kind of ability to put them in the executive service, it becomes a problem of having to work around those positions without having the confidentiality that is guaranteed by having executive service. So what the bill does, Madam Chair, is to allow executive support staff to be classified as executive service and restores more common terminology for the positions in the department, specifically establishes statutory authority for unclassified executive support positions for the deputy director and administrator positions within personnel relations law, eliminates the use of the term assistant director because that's not used any longer, and provides for the use of the term division administrator like other state agencies. This will allow for consistency and as well as allow us to appoint the executive assistants appropriately and clarifies the role as well as allows for accountability for the administrators who do the day-to-day operational work of state government within ODOT.
Right.
Open to questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mike. Does it mean any more money, just a change of title, or?
It's just a change. Actually, the title even stays the same, Madam Chair. It's the same salary range. It's called salary range 19. On some of the positions, there are a few dollars difference, like $20 or $30, but it's an immaterial amount of money. The real critical component is having that confidentiality.
Okay. Any questions of Mike on the bill? Okay, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2738, and I'll open a work session on House Bill 2738.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2738 to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Whitsett has moved House Bill 2738 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? If not, so ordered, and I will close the work session on House Bill 2738, and let's get Senator Starr maybe to carry it. And the last bill I'm going to hear today will be House Bill 2825, and I'll open the public hearing. Judith?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, House Bill 2825 allows motorhome and travel trailer specialty plates
and all Oregon Trail commemorative plates to be transferred to another vehicle without having to convert to a customized plate and to pay a customized plate fee. We have a no revenue and a minimal fiscal impact on the measure. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Robert?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Robin Freeman, the Oregon Department of Transportation. This bill allows motorhome and travel trailer specialty plates, as well as all Oregon Trail plates, to be transferred without having to convert them to custom registration and pay the additional costs. Last session, a bill was passed, Senate Bill 508, that was intended to streamline DMV's plate process by lessening the number of license plates available that simply were not selling. This included the specialty plates, Crater Lake, Cultural, and Sam, and for motorhomes and travel trailers. It also removed the language that allowed Oregon Trail plates to be transferred from vehicle to vehicle. The changes from the previous legislation caused a plate transfer restriction that upon implementation has become burdensome to the public and costly to DMV. The change from last session does not allow a customer to transfer their motorhome or travel trailer specialty plates or any Oregon Trail plates unless they are willing to convert the plates to custom registration and pay an additional $50, and that is $50 at initial registration and then also at renewal. The law states that plates not currently being issued by DMV can only be transferred if they are converted to custom registration. House Bill 2825 removes the plate transfer restriction on discontinued specialty plates and allows customers who have already purchased these plates to transfer them to another vehicle. The motorhome and travel trailer specialty plates, as well as all Oregon Trail plates, would be allowed to be transferred without converting the plate to custom registration. Without this bill, DMV will be required to make computer changes to record custom plates that have seven-digit configurations, such as the specialty plates and the Oregon Trail camper plates. The current computer programming can only accommodate a six-digit custom plate configuration. The system changes needed to accommodate a seven-digit plate configuration would cost the department approximately $450,000. We ask the committee to support House Bill 2825. This bill is needed to allow customers to continue to transfer these specialty plates and to eliminate the need for costly system changes. Thank you.
All right. Any questions of Robin on this one? Nope. All right. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2825, and I will open the work session on House Bill 2825.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2825 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Whitsett moves House Bill 2825 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered, and I will close the work session on House Bill 2825. I will move House Bill 2116, public hearing, Reverend, to next week.
Okay. So, would you like
to have
a carrier?
We need a carrier.
I'll be
happy to. Senator Metzger will carry. Okay. All right. Is there any discussion to come for the good of the order before we leave here? What about House Bill, the Senate Bill 1007? Senator Przanski, would you carry that bill?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Thank you very much. And if there's no other business coming to the body, I'll call the meeting adjourned.